In this last session this afternoon, I'd like to briefly introduce and practice the third of the three shamatha practices that we've mentioned, and that is sometimes called shamatha with no object, or sometimes called awareness of awareness practice. So what's the difference between this practice and the practice we did earlier, the one of observing the mind? So remember, in observing the mind, it's a very sort of dualistic sense to the practice. We have a sense of being this impartial observer or witness who is observing the mind and all the mental events that are arising in the mind. Whereas in this practice, the awareness of awareness practice, experientially, it's a much more non-dualistic practice. We're not having this strong sense of being this independent observer or witness. We are, so instead of observing the mind and the mental events, we are simply resting in awareness itself. And in this practice also, we are not interested in any appearances. Of course, thoughts, emotions and memories will still continue to arise. But in this practice, we're not paying attention to them. We're not trying to block them, but we're not trying to observe them arise and pass. We're simply ignoring them. We are simply resting in awareness itself. So this practice is much more about being than doing. So this is why sometimes people find this practice quite difficult, because we have to get out of this sort of dualistic sense, you know, this observer or witness sense. So to introduce this practice, I'd like to read a little bit from, again, this book from Alan Wallace, make some more comments, and then we'll dive into the practice. So this is on page 133. And this practice, this awareness of awareness practice, is, like the second practice of observing the mind, is quite emphasized in traditions that talk about the nature of the mind as a Vipassana practice. So as a basis for Vipassana practice of coming to realize the nature of the mind, then often the mind or awareness is the focus in the shamatha practice. So this would include, of course, in Tibetan Buddhism, traditions such as Mahamudra and Dzogchen within the Kagyu and Nyingma schools of Tibetan Buddhism. So let's have a look at this practice here. He says, after settling your body and mind in their natural states, you can simply be aware of being aware. You don't need to be in a sensory deprivation tank, and your mind doesn't have to be totally silenced. You can know with immediate certainty that consciousness is present, and with no other object of awareness, you can cultivate attentional stability and clarity of that awareness. Let's see how Padmasambhava describes this subtlest way of achieving shamatha. So Padmasambhava, of course, was the person who really brought Buddhism into Tibet in the 8th century, and particularly this Dzogchen practice, this nature of the mind practice within the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism. So now he's quoting Padmasambhava, who says, while steadily gazing in the space in front of you, without meditating on anything, steadily concentrate your consciousness without wavering. Increase the stability of attention and then relax again. Occasionally seek out what is it that consciousness that is concentrating. Steadily concentrate again, then check it out again. Do that in an alternating fashion. Even if there are problems of laxity and lethargy, that will dispel them. Cast your gaze downwards, gently release your mind, and without having anything on which to meditate, gently release both your body and mind into their natural state. Having nothing on which to meditate, and without any modification or adulteration, rest your attention simply without wavering, in its own natural state, in its own character, just as it is. Remain in that state of luminosity and rest your mind so that it is loose and free. Alternate between observing that which is concentrating inwardly and that which is releasing. If you think it is the mind, ask, who is it that releases the mind and concentrates the mind? Steadily observe yourself, then release again. By so doing, fine stability will arise, and you may even identify pristine awareness. If you become muddled and unmindful, you have slipped into laxity or dimness. So clear up this problem, arouse your awareness, and shift your gaze. If you become distracted and excited, it is important that you lower your gaze and release your awareness. If samadhi arises in which there is nothing of which you can say, this is meditation, this is non-conceptualization, you are slipping into a stupor. So meditate with alternating concentration and release, and recognize who is meditating. In so doing, recognize the flaws of shamatha and eliminate them right away. So a couple of points from that. First off, again, like the mind practice, it's very much recommended with this practice to have the eyes open, vacantly resting the gaze in the space in front of you. And again, as with all the shamatha practice, we need the balance between being too tight and too loose. So here also he is suggesting, as we did in the breath and the other practice of sort of doing this balancing act. And in particular here, he is saying that if we find that our mind is very tight and agitated, then one thing we can do, of course, is to lower the gaze a little bit, and then also what to do is just to release, to completely relax, and just to release the awareness, release it, releasing all appearances, really relaxing. And that if we find our mind is becoming somewhat dull or laxity is setting in, then one thing we can do, of course, is raise the gaze a bit, but then, as with the earlier practice, then arouse and refresh our focus, sharpen the focus a little bit. So that's what we're going to do a little bit in this practice as well. Once we get into the practice, we're going to do this oscillating, where we're first going to just completely relax and releasing awareness, to emphasize the relaxation, and then a little bit later is we're going to arouse and refresh the focus to overcome the dullness or laxity. So again, in this practice here, we are simply resting in awareness itself. We're simply becoming aware of being aware. Again, it's very difficult to use any words to describe what to do, but I'll try to use a few different words. And again, it's something that many people find quite difficult because it's usually something we're not that familiar with. We've never really done that in our life, to really simply be aware of being aware, because we're always focused outwards. We're always focused on something. We're not simply focusing on the fact of being aware. And so that's all we're doing in this practice. And again, if appearances will still arise, but in this practice, pay no attention to any thoughts, emotions. Don't try to block them, but don't observe them. Just leave them be and just focus on the awareness itself, resting in the awareness. I think that's all I really wanted to say. Any questions about the practice before we jump into it? Sorry? What did Padmasambhava call the practice? You can say shamatha without an object, or awareness of awareness. Oh, Dzogchen? Dzogchen is the practice that Padmasambhava brought into Tibet. It's a nature of the mind practice that is the basis of the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism. And within that practice, in the shamatha section of that practice, because also in that practice there's shamatha vipassana. In the shamatha section, we're mainly doing this type of shamatha practice. Okay? So let's do the practice. Again, 15 or 20 minutes. So again, finding a nice comfortable posture. as an act of loving kindness for yourself. Allow your awareness to descend into the body, simply becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. Again, using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. Allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. Allowing the breathing to flow naturally and effortlessly. With each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. Allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. And then allow your eyes to be at least partially open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you. And then simply release all appearances and allow the mind to come to rest. And simply rest in awareness itself. And simply be aware of being aware. Now all sorts of appearances will continue to arise, but now pay no attention to any appearance. And just simply rest within luminously clear awareness. And then release awareness into space in all directions, completely relaxing, releasing all appearances. And then bring your awareness right in upon itself, right into the present moment, and focus and concentrate. Clear and alert. And then once again, releasing awareness, releasing all appearances, completely relaxed. And once again, bringing your awareness right in upon itself, arouse and refresh the focus. clear and alert. And then simply rest within luminously clear awareness. Relaxed and alert. Open and spacious. We can bring the meditation to a close. Any questions or comments about that practice? It helps you. Is that your, is that what you're saying? You find it easier to have the eyes closed? Yes, I mean, particularly if we're not used to meditating with the eyes open, both this and the previous practice, you probably find a little bit disconcerting. But again, I think that with this practice, there are a lot of advantages having the eyes open. So what I'd recommend is to try this, persevere with the eyes open. Also, of course, here it's not very optimal conditions, a lot of movement and things going on, so it's easy to get distracted. But again, when we're at home, we can make sure that where we meditate is there's no movement, maybe not a lot of color, just something very plain, and also adjust the lighting. You know, I like particularly quite dim. And then if you try with that, I think you might find that it becomes easier. And also with the eyes open, you'll find that the clarity will really improve. With eyes closed, I think you'll find it maybe quite difficult to have some vividness and clarity of awareness itself. So that's what I can recommend, is just try it at home in a better conditions around you. Totally.
At sea.
At sea. Oh, okay. Yes, because again, this is a practice that we're not so familiar with, just sort of being aware, because we are living in this dualistic world. We're always focusing on something, whether it's external phenomena or some thought or emotion in our mind. So we are always outwardly focused. We're never, because it's all these appearances, whether they're physical or mental, are appearing within that space of awareness. But we are never so, implicitly we're aware of being aware of these objects, but we never really are explicitly aware of being aware, because explicitly we're aware of the appearances. So we're just shifting our focus from being explicitly aware of the appearances to being explicitly aware of that awareness within which all appearances arise. So it'll take time to get used to it. Sorry? Yeah. I mean, we are. I mean, you know, we're explicitly aware of what's in front of us, you know. Implicitly, of course, we're aware that we are aware of that, aren't we? Implicitly, that's how we have memory, because we know that we saw that. That's implicit. But here in this practice, we're making that explicit. We're simply becoming explicitly aware of being this awareness within which all these appearances arise. So again, it takes time to familiarize ourselves with this practice, and many people do really find this practice quite foreign or difficult in the initial phases because of that. Because, sorry? Yeah, again, with this practice, or any sort of instructional language can be misleading, because they're all about doing something. So this practice is more about being than doing. So it's difficult to really give good instruction for this practice. But again, we just have to sort of work with it, and I think we'll start to appreciate the practice as we work with it. Anything else? Yeah. Maybe I can mention that now. As I mentioned earlier, with the shamatha practice, the general recommendation is to use the object that works best for us. And I think for most of us, that's probably going to be the breath, one of those variations. The three objects we used, in terms of the object itself, each one is more subtle, because the mental events is not physical or tangible. And then, of course, awareness within itself, awareness is more subtle than any appearance. So in terms of the subtlety of the object, we have that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that one is better than the other in terms of the basis for shamatha practice for us as an individual. So again, we can use the object that works best for us, or as Alan Wallace suggests in the book here, we can go through these stages. So I'll just read a little bit what he says on this point. This is on page 6. He says, to guide meditators through these 10 stages, and the 10 stages are these diagrams which we're going to briefly look at now, the stages to shamatha. He says, to guide meditators through these 10 stages, I have chosen from Buddhist teachings three techniques that I have found effective for people in the modern world. These three techniques are the basis for the three divisions of this book. For the first four stages, you should practice whatever method you find easiest. By stage five, the mind is relatively stable and you can move on to subtler techniques. For achieving the first four stages, I recommend the practice of mindfulness of breathing, variations of which can be found in Zen, Vipassana, and Tibetan Buddhism. Mindfulness of breathing means settling your awareness on the sensations involved in breathing, continually returning your attention there whenever your mind wanders. Beginning with the fifth stage, I recommend a method called settling the mind in its natural state. In this technique, you direct your attention to mental experiences, that is, all the thoughts, mental images, and emotions that arise in the domain of the mind. This method is drawn from the Dzogchen lineage, but is found in other Buddhist traditions as well. With the instructions for the eighth attentional stage onward, we move on to the still subtler practice of maintaining awareness of awareness itself. The technique is called shamatha without an object. Here the practice is not so much one of developing attentional stability and clarity as it is of discovering the stillness and luminosity inherent in awareness itself. The training in mindfulness of breathing may be helpful to anyone, including those seeking to prevent or treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorders. Many people find the second practice, that of settling the mind in its natural state, to be more challenging, but some meditators take to it naturally. Likewise, the practice of awareness is subtler still, but it may be optimal from the beginning for those who are strongly drawn to it. You may use any one of the three methods to progress along all 10 stages of attentional development, or you may follow the sequence described in this book. How fast you progress will depend on the level of your commitment and the degree to which your lifestyle and environment support such practice. So again, use the object that works best for us. Probably for most of us, that's going to be the breath. We can use an approach suggested, as he has suggested, to start with the breath until we get a significant way, then move on to the observing the mind to get nearly most of the way, and then finally move to the awareness of awareness practice. Or if we find from the very beginning that the awareness of awareness practice is suitable, we can use that the whole way. We can use the breath the whole way. We can use the mind the whole way. So there are these options. But as I mentioned earlier, it's not much recommended to keep changing the object from one week to the next. That's a little bit counterproductive. So let's now then look at the stages of development here very briefly for the remaining 20 minutes today. So this describes shamatha, first off, is the diagram in the middle at the top. And we find there are nine sort of stages that we go through on the way to achieving the goal of shamatha. So let's have a brief look at some of these points, which could be some practical advice for us in our practice. So right down the bottom, of course, we have the meditator. In the left hand of the meditator, we have that rope. So you see a lot of small numbers here describing various points. They're all described on the back, on the second page, the numbers. So down the bottom we have the meditator. In the left hand is this rope. So remember again, this is symbolizing the rope of mindfulness. We are trying to tie our mind with the rope of mindfulness to the meditative object. In the meditator's right hand is a hook. This is the hook of introspection, to notice when we become dull or distracted and to hook the mind back to the object. We have the elephant. The elephant symbolizes the mind in general. The fact that it is black is symbolizing this dullness or laxity. The monkey is symbolizing conceptual thought in general. The fact that it is black is symbolizing this excitement, the most common reason why we become distracted. So here at stage one at the bottom, we see that the elephant and monkey are running wildly out ahead of the meditator, meaning that our mind is completely out of control. This first stage is called setting the mind. And at this first stage, as we can see from this diagram, one of the first things we notice is that our mind is really completely out of control. If we've never done this sort of meditative practice before, we could live in under the illusion that our mind is sort of okay, you know. Okay, sometimes I have some agitation and distraction and dullness, but I think I should be able to focus on the breath okay. Maybe I get a bit distracted, but I think I can do that not too bad. But then, of course, when we sit down and try to focus on the breath, then often what happens, of course, within 3 to 5 seconds, completely gone, completely distracted, and often distracted for many minutes before we realize we're distracted. We go, hang on, I'm supposed to be on the breath. We come back to the breath for another 3 to 5 seconds, gone again. And so this is often what happens. But, of course, often in the beginning phase, because that happens, we think, oh, I must be doing something wrong, you know, because it's not working, you know. It's actually worse than that. Since I started meditating, my mind has got worse, you know. Before, it used to sort of be okay, but now, since I started meditating, it's gone crazy. So I definitely must be doing something wrong. And it's even worse than that because, in fact, everyone else is still in the room. I'm the only one who can't meditate. Everyone else seems to be doing a pretty good job. So this is often the experience people have when they begin. If this is your experience, don't worry. You can meditate. You've made it to step one. You're making progress. Because one of the first signs of progress in this practice is simply noticing how chaotic and out of control our mind really is. So that is actually stage one. If we continue in the practice, we'll get around the corner to stage two. And in stage two, we see the elephant and monkey are not running so fast. There's a little bit of white on the top of the head of the monkey and the elephant. That white is symbolizing a little bit of stability and clarity coming into the meditation, which means by stage two of our practice, we'll start to notice some periods of our meditation where our mind has settled down a bit more. Maybe we can focus on the object up to a minute or two, and our mind seems to be a little bit settled. But still at stage two, we're very often distracted, and when we're distracted, often we're distracted for long periods of time. So even at stage two, we tend to be more distracted from the object than on the object. If we keep going around to stage three, which is called resetting, now we see that the rope of mindfulness is tied to the elephant of the mind, meaning by stage three, our mindfulness is improving now, so much that now we can focus on the object for maybe 5 or 10 minutes before we're distracted, and when we're distracted, we quickly recognize that and quickly come back, and that is symbolized by the elephant with the head turning backwards, meaning we quickly recognize distraction and come back to the object. Here at stage three, we see the rabbit has come into the picture on the back of the elephant. The rabbit is symbolizing what's called subtle dullness or subtle laxity. Because by stage three, we can focus reasonably well on the object, and if we become distracted, we quickly come back. So we could be already under the illusion at stage three that we're close to achieving some sort of shamatha, because things seem to be going very well now. But what, of course, is not still a lot of work to be done is the clarity of our attention. Even though by stage three we can hold the object not too bad, the clarity of our focus still needs a lot of work. And so that is subtle dullness, subtle laxity. Of course, we had this subtle dullness before, but before in stage one and two we had much heavier problems to worry about. But by stage three, we have to start to recognize this little bit of subtle dullness and sharpen the focus a little bit. Stage four is called close placement. By stage four, mindfulness is getting quite good now, meaning we can hold the object the entire session without ever completely losing it. But still, quite a lot of work to be done on improving the quality of our attention. So we see around the corner of stage five and six, we see now the hook of introspection is much more prominent. Meaning now, of course, at the beginning of our practice, our introspection was to notice if we've become completely distracted or nearly falling asleep, heavy dullness. But by stage five and six, our introspection is to simply monitor the quality of our attention. If we notice that we're a little bit agitated, a little bit dull, to notice that and then to adjust it. And so this is what stage five and six is a lot about, is fine-tuning the focus. If we're too dull, sharpen the focus. If we're a little bit agitated, relax a bit. Again, the analogy of a guitar string. If a guitar string is too tight or too loose, it doesn't play well. We have to fine-tune it. So here on stage five and six, we are fine-tuning our focus. So much so that we see by the end of stage six, around to stage seven, the rabbit is gone. We're saying goodbye to the monkey. There's hardly any black left on the elephant. So by stage seven, now we can subtle dullness, subtle agitation, very minor, and we can quickly dispel it. By stage eight, now everything becomes effortless, that we can simply, with a bit of effort, start the meditation and then effortlessly focus in a very clear, stable way for an extended period of time without any hint of any sort of dullness or agitation. Stage nine, then the whole thing becomes completely spontaneous, and we can do that for many hours at a time. But still, we have not got to shamatha. So how do we get from stage nine to shamatha, which is in the middle at the top there? The transition is a very specific transition, and how that happens, again, I'll read from Alan Wallace's book here. On page 155, he says, following the realization of the ninth stage of attentional balance, after months or years of continuous full-time practice, you are primed to achieve shamatha. The nine preceding stages entail many incremental changes, but the actual accomplishment of shamatha involves a radical transition in your body and mind. You will be like a butterfly emerging from its cocoon. This shift is characterized by specific experiences that take place within a discrete, relatively brief period of time. According to accounts from the Indo-Tibetan tradition of Buddhism, the first sign of the achievement of shamatha is the experience of a sense of heaviness and numbness on the top of the head. This allegedly happens to anyone who experiences this transition, regardless of the specific method followed. It is said to feel as if a palm were being placed on the top of your head. It is not unpleasant or harmful, just unusual. Something remarkable must be taking place in the cortical region of your brain at this point, but so far no one has monitored the brain correlates of this shift using magnetic resonance imaging or an electroencephalograph. This physical sensation on the top of the head is symptomatic of a shift in your nervous system or network of vital energies that is correlated with gaining freedom from mental dysfunction, a general state of mental imbalance characterized by stiffness, rigidity, and unwieldiness. Consequently, you achieve a state of mental pliancy, in which your mind is fit and supple like never before. From a contemplative perspective, when the mind is dysfunctional or prone to laxity and excitation, it is hard to generate enthusiasm for healing the afflictions of your mind or for devoting yourself to virtuous mental activity. Once you are free of such mental dysfunction, you can focus your mind without resistance on any meaningful object or task. And such a mind is now said to be fit or serviceable. This is the key to achieving optimal mental performance. So this is symbolized in the middle at the top here. We see the meditator riding on the back of the elephant of the mind, meaning now we can direct our mind without any resistance to anything we wish. He goes on to say, following this sense of pressure on the top of your head, you experience the movement of vital energies moving in your body. And when they have coursed everywhere throughout your body, you feel as if you are filled with the power of this dynamic energy. You are now freed of physical dysfunction, so your body feels buoyant and light like never before. So that's symbolized by the meditator flying through the sky, his physical pliancy. It's said that our body will feel light like cotton. Both your body and mind are now imbued with an exceptional degree of pliancy, which makes them remarkably fit for engaging in all kinds of mental training and other meaningful activities. When physical pliancy initially arises, the vital energies catalyze an extraordinary sense of physical bliss, which then triggers an equally exceptional experience of mental bliss. This rush of physical and mental rapture is transient, which is a good thing, for it so captivates the attention that you can do little else except enjoy it. Gradually it subsides, and you are freed from the turbulence caused by this intense joy. Your attention settles down in perfect stability and clarity. You have now achieved shamatha.
Sounds pretty good. One more diagram up the top here. We see right at the top, in the corner, we see now the meditator on the elephant of the mind. We see in their right hand a sword, and we see a flame behind them. The flame is the amount of effort we need. So in the shamatha, at the bottom of the diagram along this road, the flame was very big, meaning we need to put a lot of effort into our mindfulness and introspection. But as we move closer and closer to shamatha, it becomes really effortless and spontaneous. But now, once we've achieved shamatha, then shamatha, of course, is the basis of vipassana practice. So this last diagram is symbolizing vipassana practice, that we need to put effort now, again, in analyzing, investigating the nature of reality. And the right hand, the sword, is the sword of wisdom, the wisdom sword to cut ignorance. So this is symbolizing the vipassana practice, right, on the basis of shamatha. There's a lot more to say about the diagram, but maybe that's enough for a brief introduction. If anyone has any questions about this diagram, then you can ask that now. I didn't hear, sorry. Sorry? Where? No? There's just one elephant. There's nine diagrams. I mean, two of the stages, seven and eight, are very close together, but there are two stages here, not two elephants. That would mean we'd have two minds, then we'd be in trouble. No, these are individual stages. Any other questions? Okay, yeah. So, a couple of points on that is, first is, how do we know we're at a certain stage? So each stage, the typical experience is described. To be at a particular stage means that our average normal experience, that's our average normal experience. So, for example, stage three meant we could focus on the object normally 5 to 10 minutes. If we become distracted, we quickly come back. If that's our normal experience in shamatha practice, we're at stage three. But of course, even now, we may on a particular day once have that experience. That doesn't mean we're at stage three. So we can be at a stage, and in a given day, maybe be one or two stages above, or at the same, or one or two stages below. But that should be our average experience. So that's what it means to be at that stage. And then can we, once we get to a certain level, can we regress? So we can use an analogy here. If we go to a gym and we achieve a certain level of mental fitness, if we stop going to the gym, do we stay at that level? No. So similarly here, if we get to stage three and we stop meditating, we'll slowly go back. So it's the same idea as a gym. Exactly. So remember on yesterday evening I said that practice, there is formal meditation and then what we do for the rest of the day, how we integrate into the day. So if we do shamatha practice, let's say we diligently every morning do 1 hour shamatha practice. But then if we jump up and run around in a very hectic, mindless way for the 15 hours, which is going to be more powerful? 1 hour of mindfulness or 14 hours of mindless activity? I mean, what's going to happen there? I mean, that's going to sort of like crush that a little bit. So if we do our 30 minutes or 1 hour or whatever in the morning, that's a good start. And then we can consciously work on being mindful through the day, then we can build on that and that will feed back in. On top of that, and we're going to talk about that tomorrow afternoon in the last session, we need, as you mentioned, a conducive lifestyle. Yeah. So we need to make sure that we have a sort of lifestyle that supports this sort of practice. And of course, at the minimum level, that must be ethics. I mean, if we are engaging in a very unethical, harmful lifestyle, that's not really going to support this sort of practice. And there are other things that we need to work on to provide that conducive lifestyle. And we're going to talk about some of those factors in more detail tomorrow afternoon. Yeah. So yes, it's a combination of all those factors. Formal meditation, integrating into daily life, and then having a conducive, supportive lifestyle as well. Yeah. Okay. Well, actually, next month at Tushita, I'm doing actually a 9-day shamatha retreat. And so in that, I'll be sort of going through basically the three objects that we did today, you know, like this. I'll be spending a couple of days on each one. So generally what I do is I tend to spend like 2 days on the breath at the beginning because that's the main one. And then a full day on the mind, a full day on the awareness. So after about 4 or 5 days, we've had a bit of a flavor for each one of those objects. And then for the next 2 days, or maybe 3 days, depending on how long the course is, then what I do is I allow people to select one of those and then work with that for those couple of days to go a little bit deeper. So this is what I do. And then usually the last day I then bring in a little bit of Vipassana practice sort of as the sort of the next step. So that's how I tend to format it. Any other questions about this chart? Maybe one or two more things then that I can mention before we finish. Remember I said the most common form of distraction is this excitement. We get distracted by the sense pleasures. So they are symbolized here by the 5 sense objects. We see sort of in the middle here a bowl of fruit. So that is taste. Next to it we see a silk cloth. So that is tactile sensation. Above the silk cloth we have 2 round objects. They are symbols, so that is sound. To the left of this round object we see a shell. That's a conch shell with perfume, so that's smell. And then slightly above that we see another round object that is a mirror. So that is visual objects. So they are the 5 sense objects that are the most common form of distraction in the shamatha practice. One other thing to mention, we see number 19, the monkey in the tree, sort of up near the cave, just underneath the cave. You see the monkey in the tree, number 19. And then if we look over the back, what number 19 says, it says, since virtuous thoughts are an interruption at the time of shamatha meditation, it is necessary to stop them. At other times, it is not necessary. Because what you're going to notice in the shamatha practice is as your mind starts to settle down and your mind becomes this very sort of open and spacious still, what you're going to notice is a lot of things are going to be bubbling up, and often it's very creative thoughts. You know, maybe you've been working on some problem you can't solve, and all of a sudden, boom, here comes the solution. And so you'll have a lot of these great and sometimes very virtuous thoughts. What it's saying here is that if you have these things coming up in the practice, that is not the time to entertain them. So if you have some great idea come up in the middle of shamatha meditation, don't follow that great idea. If you're worried about forgetting it, have a little notepad, just jot down the key word and leave it, and then work with that after the meditation. You have plenty of time to work with that after. So even virtuous thoughts in the middle of shamatha practice is an obstacle. So and so not to entertain all these great ideas that come up in the middle of meditation. Entertain them after you've done the meditation. That's the right time to work on them. I think that's all I wanted to mention. We've run out of time now. So just to mention tomorrow, so we have the same schedule, 10 till 4:30. So tomorrow we're going to look at the Vipassana practice. In the first session in the morning, I want to look at how our distorted view of reality leads to our mental afflictions and suffering. And to do that, I'm going to be looking at this suffering and its causes chart. So if you want to already have a bit of a look at that before tomorrow, that could be helpful. But I'll be going through this in the first session in the morning. Then in the second session, I'm going to be looking at this idea of emptiness. There's no independent me, independent world, that in fact everything is a dependent phenomena. We're going to establish this view of emptiness, dependent arising. In the third session after lunch, we're going to look at how do we meditate on this emptiness by focusing on ourselves as a person. So how to do the Vipassana practice in terms of emptiness. And in the fourth session, we're going to look at how we integrate both shamatha and Vipassana practice into daily life. So that's the program for tomorrow. So 4:30, so let's stop there. So have a nice evening, and I'll see you tomorrow morning. Thank you.